Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. Hope you're doing well this week. We're almost into February of 2021, which happens to be my birthday month. And every year as I get older, I'm in my 50s right now, I think about my health. Thankfully, I'm in decent health. I do work at it in terms of diet and exercise. But as I get older, I guess it's natural that I wonder what's in store for me in the years ahead. My mother turned 90 years old recently, and she's still sharp as a tack. She has great brain health. Now, I hope that that means I'll have good brain health into my later years, but it turns out that genes only play a small part when it comes to brain health. Today, it's a conversation with two doctors and researchers who will tell us what else is at work and how we can boost our brain health and reduce our chances of getting Alzheimer's disease by more than 90%. Doctors Dean and Aisha Shirzai were on this podcast in 2017 to promote their book, The Alzheimer's Solution. They have a new book coming out in March titled The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution. So I thought today might be a good day to revisit that 2017 conversation. It was one of those conversations that really made me think and truly left an impact on me in terms of the way I think about diet and other factors and their impact on brain health. The Shirzais are co-directors of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. They have too many degrees and qualifications to count, but in short, they know what they're talking about. So I hope you'll take a listen as a first step toward better brain health for you. Here's my conversation with Drs. Dean and Aisha Shirzai.
Dr. Shirzai and Dr. Shirzai, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. And this is such an interesting and provocative book, The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. So before we get too deep into it, just tell us, lay out the theory, or I don't know if it's theory or how you would describe it, but your proposition.
So what we're saying is actually not controversial at all. There's just been a disconnect. It's almost as if heart disease is a lifestyle disease, and many other diseases are lifestyle. Type 2 diabetes is a lifestyle disease. Yet the brain, because it's a closed box, nobody knows about it, it's not. And the only label they put is genetics. It's not. We know that genetics is a component of all diseases. I mean, we are genetic beings. For some diseases, the genetics determine the outcome. Huntington's disease, if the father has it, we know when the son will have it and all that. But for a great deal of chronic diseases, it determines a range because it's not even one gene. For 95% of Alzheimer's, it's not one gene. It's multiple, more than 20 to 30 genes and different amounts. And that determines a range of possibility of when you could potentially get it, depending on what happens to you in life. And we want to actually empower the population to say, this is not a foregone conclusion. Your genes don't determine outcome. What you do in life does matter. Forget about Alzheimer's, but actually living fulfilled, vibrant, brain-healthy lives well into your 80s and 90s. It's in your hand. Nothing controversial. And the data is, I mean, it's replete. For 80 years on other sides, we've seen it. Now on the brain, it's accumulating. Nutrition data, she's actually written one of the national papers on brain health and nutrition, exercise, and the types, specific types, and what you do for yourself. Brain activity, the kind of job you have. You know, one of the biggest factors was the complexity of the job was the biggest protective factor. You know, how's that? Because your brain is not a muscle. It's way more than a muscle.
And the idea is that if you're using your brain, using all of your brain at a complex level, you're constantly growing it or making it stronger?
Absolutely. And we have evidence of people who have complex jobs and complex lives. They actually have a bigger brain. They have more connections. And, you know, you can have as little as a couple of connections between cells to as many as 20,000 connections. So I believe that's a great news for us because that tells us that those connections can be built throughout our lifetime. And we have so many things that can actually build those connections and build the brain.
You talked about these various factors, the various genes that can influence the sort of outcome of your brain, and specifically with Alzheimer's. I always thought that, well, if my grandfather had Alzheimer's or my grandmother, that there is a pretty good chance that I would have Alzheimer's. Isn't that sort of what most people believe?
They do. That's what they believe. But so,
and it's wrong.
It is wrong. It is completely wrong. Yes, there are genes that increase your risk, but risk does not mean outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of those 30 genes that we talked about, the few genes that are more strongly associated, such as APOE4, a very commonly known gene that increases your risk if you have two of those, one from parent and one from your mom and one from your father, your risk increases as much as 12 to 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
But still, 50% of them don't get it.
Because
of lifestyle, because of what you've done in life and, you know, all that stuff. And then the same thing with these, even the very strongly genetically driven Alzheimer's types, they call them presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and APP. Even in those populations, which it's one powerful gene in Alzheimer's, and it's less than 5% of the population and of Alzheimer's population. Even in those populations, lifestyle influences it. It doesn't stop it. They will get in their lifestyle, but it will influence it significantly. But for the other 90 to 95%, so when we say 90%, it's not controversial. And now all this other data, which actually I reviewed, is coming to show us that how much nutrition will affect you.
So hold on. Let me just understand what you're saying. So 90 to 95% of people who might get Alzheimer's can, through lifestyle changes, prevent it or reduce the effects of it?
Definitely,
both.
Yes. During their normal lifespan, they can reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And we've seen it from studies of epigenetics, which is how does your lifestyle and everything you do on a daily basis affect your genes? And we've mm-hmm. seen that being in a good environment, meaning good food, exercise, no stress, can actually change and shift your genes in a way that it doesn't manifest into the disease later on as well. Mm.
And is it one of those diseases where, you may have a genetic predisposition to get something and there's a trigger that then sends you down that road? Is that what Alzheimer's is with these 25 to 30 genes?
Absolutely. So, I mean, even if you look at the genes, these are inflammation genes. They are immune response genes. They're what they call lysosomal or getting rid of waste genes. So these are normal parts of genes. As it happens, some people have worse versions and better versions. I'm simplifying it. So as you're getting older, let's say you have a concussion. And that pushes you. So that concussion, what does concussion do? Vascular damage, so the little vessels, so microvascular damage, as well as inflammation.
Mm.
So inflammation, then the body overreacts, and then this whole cycle starts. Let's say you haven't been eating well, both saturated fats and sugars. And what happens is your glucose abnormalities and then fat abnormalities, that creates inflammation, that creates other things. This whole cascade starts. So all of a sudden, you were able to resist all this in your 20s and your 30s. It just starts accumulating one after other, and you don't see it until the first manifestation of memory problems in your 50s and 60s,
mm.
but the damage has started much earlier. In fact, we even see the proteins, the bad proteins, amyloid, starting 10 to 15 to 20 years earlier. The vascular disease, that's why we think that it's at the core, it's a vascular disease, which you can reverse, starts much earlier. So that's why, like you explained it perfectly, it's as the years go, these different things actually influence the genes and how it manifests.
You do something really interesting in your book. You have a risk assessment, and you
yes.
essentially ask a series of questions, and people can sort of check off, and then you add up the numbers, and you come up with your risk.
Yes.
If I fill this out, and I find out that I'm really high, and I'm 53 right now, is it too late for me?
Not at all. It's never too late for anyone. And everything you do, whether it's the smallest of changes in your lifestyle or, you know, a massive change, a comprehensive change, it all matters at all. I think the reason we put that risk assessment there is to remind people of the fact that this disease actually starts way earlier, and it's never too late to get assessed and to find out and highlight the risk factors and some of the things that we don't do very well in our daily lifestyle and focus on that.
I don't want to take everyone through all of the risk factors, but just give us a sense of some of the areas in the risk assessment So that people can start to think about, these are the areas that I need to work on.
Yeah. So the things that we call it modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. The non-modifiable are your parents, your mom, your dad,
your age,
your age, the number of family members that who've had Alzheimer's, things like that that you have no control over, and then your genes. Yes, even the genes we talk about that. But then the modifiable ones, which are more important. Now, again, this assessment is not a perfect reflection of life. Nobody has that kind of data. We just wanted to kind of lay it out for you to see the relationship. The modifiable ones are, we call it neuro, N-E-U-R-O. The O has three components, but N is nutrition. And we actually put a list and number next to each of them, the good foods and bad foods. Exercise, the amount of exercise you've done, the type of exercise. It's not just, in our book, it's not just exercise, but the type of exercise. And more importantly, the amount of sedentary life where, you sit around and do nothing. That's important as well. Third is unwind as neuro stress. We were talking about this earlier. All stress is not bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stress, actually, if that's yours, it has purpose, it has direction. That's actually good. It's almost like putting stress as a bodybuilder. It builds the brain. But stress that actually is not yours, not controlled, doesn't have time bound, it creates such amount of pressure on the brain that it actually kills cells. A fourth one is R, restorative sleep, not just sleep. A lot of people sleep, but it's bad sleep. And they you have to go through cycles. We call sleep the ultimate
detox.
The ultimate detox. You know, in LA, you see all these people coming with detox from above and below. And out. There's one detox, sleep.
And it's one you should have nightly.
It's the most important thing. If it wasn't the most important thing, why would your body sacrifice? Remember, when you're sleeping, imagine thousands of years ago, your body's at risk. You're out.
Mm-hmm.
So why would it put it in such risk? Because it's detoxifying this incredible organ. 3 pounds. 2% of the body, but uses 25% of the energy.
To imagine all the byproducts that are created.
Yeah.
And we've actually seen that one night of sleep deprivation can cause so much damage.
Wow.
There's deposition of the bad proteins, beta amyloid, that has been associated with Alzheimer's disease. Just one night. And when Dean and I read that paper, we looked at each other, as residents and as doctors. I mean, how many nights have we not slept?
Yes.
So,
How much smarter I would have been. Oh, my God.
Such a smarter person.
And can I catch up on sleep just to follow that for a second? I mean, if I get, let's say I go through 5.5 hours of good sleep, right? But it's not exactly what I need in a day. I know my body, 7.5 hours is perfect for me, right? And many people, 7.5, 8.5, exactly. 9.5. Somewhere in that range. But I know for me that it's 7.5. If I wake up at 7.5, I'm feeling good. Mm-hmm. It's in the perfect time in my cycle.
Right.
But many nights, it's 6 hours or even 5.5. And then I try to make up for it. I take a nap in the afternoon. Is that enough, or have I hurt myself already?
Unfortunately, we've hurt ourselves already. Mm. They've looked at this, napping patterns and sleepless nights, and especially for shift workers who actually sleep during the day and stay up in the night. This whole cycle of sleep gets dysregulated, and it definitely does a lot of damage on the long run. So unfortunately, you can't really make up for it, because again, it's all about reaching the specific stages of sleep.
Yeah.
And all of these stages are responsible for consolidating memory, putting into the filing cabinet so you can retrieve them later, and getting rid of all the toxins and the byproducts that have accumulated during the day.
It's almost like doing a reboot and then stopping halfway through the reboot.
Yes.
So rebooted some of it, but not the whole system.
I'm dating myself. I'm going to date myself a couple of times, but the defragging, with the computer, these folders, that's exactly. So two things for sleep. One is it's detoxing. The other one is reorganizing. Cleaning the pathways that were bad, reorganizing, putting the memories. That's why people who don't get a good night's sleep repeatedly, they did worse on exams the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, although you can't make up for that, the brain is so resilient that although you can't make up for that damage, but if you get back on a regular pattern, you do all these brain exercises and build your brain and all that, then the brain will do fine, just fine. It's just that it's important to make the changes quick enough and early enough that you will get the benefit, the most benefit.
I see. Yeah. And I think I stopped you at R. What is O?
Oh, O is optimizing mental and social activity, and also optimizing, I couldn't say neuro, so we have to, and optimizing your medical state. If you have high blood pressure, we're not against medicine. So some lifestyle doctors say, no, medicine has its place. If somebody comes in repeatedly with a blood pressure of 180, we're not going to say stop your medicine and go, you know, eat this. No. You have to optimize your medicine. If you have high cholesterol, if you had stroke, mm-hmm. optimize those. And then slowly switch from the lifestyle so that the medicine is no longer needed. But it's, that's over months. But optimizing mental activity and social activity is critical. Mental activity is the of the two things that grow the brain, the other things protect. This also protects, but grow the brain as exercise and mental activity. Any time in life you start challenging activities that you enjoy, we were telling in another talk that if they made me do Sudoku, I would have worse than dementia. I would have the depression, you name it. Right. I hate Sudoku. Not that there's anything wrong with Sudoku. It's not me.
Right.
I like playing. I mean, my wife sings beautifully, but I play a horrible guitar.
Uh-huh.
But the noise I make. But I love that, and I challenge myself with that. And that to me, now let's look at that. Playing guitar is not just Sudoku, which is linear. You're doing motor skills,
yep.
which is motor part of the brain. You're processing, which is the front of the brain. You're remembering and recalling, which is the memory center of the brain. Mm-hmm. You're looking at the instruments and the notes, and it's the visual. You're involving the entire brain plus one added benefit, the emotional component.
Mm.
At least for me. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is bad.
I disagree. That's good.
But I would love to see under a scan to see the brain learning to play guitar, because yes. I bet it must light up, right?
It does, all over.
Yeah.
All over the brain. Yeah. The same thing with other activities, such as dancing. You know, when people say brain activities, they think when they come to me, I say, first of all, this is the hardest part, because I can't give you a recipe. It has to come from you. Mm. That's part of the book, is how you find yourself within this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It's not just about throwing lifestyle at you. Dance is complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's movement, it's memory, it's processing, it's emotion, it's all of the brain, plus exercise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, compare that to some simple dot on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
A dot on a screen, ironically, even those helped for the brain. But doing dance, learning dance later in life is way more complex than anything like that.
Right.
And it's enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, it's enjoyable for some people. My wife doesn't want to see me dance. So it would not be enjoyable for her. Yeah. Now you're co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. And we know that Loma Linda is in a blue zone.
Correct.
And a blue zone, places like Sardinia, Okinawa, I don't know all of them, but I know that these are places where people have longer and healthier lives.
Yes.
And you've studied people who live in Loma Linda mm-hmm. and people who live across the freeway in San Bernardino.
Yes.
And what did you find?
Huge disparity in health. The Seventh-day Adventist population in Loma Linda University have, you know, most of them follow a vegetarian diet, and they are quite active in their community, in their church. They take Sabbath seriously, which is rest, and they're a very highly connected community. So, you know, all of these things actually build the brain and prevent diseases, and they have documentation of that from their own population, the Seventh-day Adventist study, where they actually live 10 years longer, and they have lower risk of cancer, coronary heart disease,
diabetes
and dementia. Mm. So we were privileged to actually study that population. But even more important, like you said, just across the highway, just a couple of miles away, you have one of the unhealthiest communities. And it's because of the lack of all those lifestyle factors there. You know, there is misunderstanding.
And we should be clear, you're not condemning people. You're not criticizing
not
them.
At all.
You're just looking at the data.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, that culture of health is non-existent. And it's probably because of the lack of information about all these fantastic studies that are going on. Dean and I really believe that there is a big disconnect between the scientific world and public.
Hmm.
And there's very limited data that flows from, you know, what's going on in the epidemiological world and the prevention world to the public. And so that's one of the reasons why.
And the field's been muddied even more now, because people want to publish book. And recently somebody on Time Magazine, butter is good for you, or, you know, bacon is good for you. So everybody wants to hear this. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't want to hear that? That's not the case. There's no data. There's no information. There's only anecdotal and soft studies. But the studies, as far as the kind of lifestyle we're talking about, 80 years of cumulative evidence in other diseases and now in brain as well. Mm-hmm. There's no question of this. And we were talking about communities. Of course, there's no blame. It's like saying people who have heart attack. It's about empowering communities. And it's not just San Bernardino. It's throughout our nation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go to the south. We go to the east. The information is not transferring. And the prevalence of Alzheimer's. Remember that every other disease is on decline. Dementia, Alzheimer's, in the last 10 years has gone up by 80%.
Mm.
Now, the direct cost of Alzheimer's is $230 billion. Indirect cost, another $200 billion. So the second costliest disease is heart disease, $100 billion. That's how much difference there is.
Mm.
And Alzheimer's is expected to go by 2050 to as much as $1 to $3 trillion.
Oh, my goodness.
That's going to overwhelm our system in general.
Yeah.
And it's not about blame. It's about the fact that the communities can empower themselves. In fact, that's why we're putting 100% of the profits from this book back into the communities. Because if we don't do that, if we go one Aricept at a time, it's unethical on our part. So yeah. we have to go. And we actually volunteer in communities all the time, educating, empowering. That's an epidemic that's going to overwhelm us.
Yeah, let's go back through the neuro,
yes,
and talk about nutrition. Just in a snapshot, you talked about the vegetarian diet being, or at least plant-based,
yeah,
being very important.
Right.
What does that mean? Am I allowed to? I mean, and I know Doctor used to love a good steak. I still love a good steak.
Yes.
Am I not allowed to have a good ribeye anymore?
Oh, you sure are. We don't make an all or none phenomenon about it. What we're trying to say is that here's the data. It's quite clear. It's nothing new. We've known this for a very, very long time, that certain foods increase your risk for dementia. Trying to stay away from it and trying to reduce it is the goal. Hmm. So working towards increasing foods that are good for the brain is the goal, and working towards eliminating ones that are not good. And, you know, it's
so talk, just take me through meats for a second.
Sure.
Because, yes, I want to be plant-based, but I'm going to have some meat.
Sure.
So if I'm going to have meat, how much beef is okay? How much chicken? Should it be fish? What are we talking about?
Well, so we have evidence that shows that, you know, meat definitely increases the risk for dementia. And red meat specifically. Red meat and processed meats. And we know this from the Adventist Health Study. We know this from the Women's Health Initiative. We know this from the Kaiser Permanente studies. And we were talking about thousands of individuals going through this. We have a combination of the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professional Study, about 131,000 people who, showed that the ones that consumed meat had a higher chance of cognitive impairment later on in life. So the data is replete. How does that apply in our daily lives? You know, what we try to say is, if you eat meat every single day, try to cut it down to maybe 5 or 6 times a week initially, and then slowly and gradually work towards getting into a healthier mm-hmm. pattern. So it's not radical. It's not deprivation. How about just replacing your meat with some beans or some whole wheat or some vegetables so that you're not hungry, so that you're not deprived, but at the same time, you're replacing the meat and replacing the harmful things with beneficial things. You know, they actually have fiber and minerals that create that perfect environment for the brain to thrive, to connect.
That's how actually we failed patients, is all or none. Because we don't have the time to talk to the patients. So at the door, hi, by the way, I checked the heart, the knee. By the way, eat healthy. That's it. And what happens is the person is left so helpless that not only do they give up on the diet, they give up on all of the, even the pills, because what do I do? Where do I start?
Right.
And so that's the problem. So the way we approach it is, for you, if meat is your core at this point, pick something else that's unhealthy that you think you can be successful at. Because the concept of motivation, we actually talk about this, there is no such thing as motivation. It's repeated successes that create a pattern and an emotion connected to that. Mm. Actually, that's my definition. So what can you cut out that's unhealthy in that list that you think you can do easily? Build success around that, and that actually starts a whole cycle of success. Then the next thing, and not all of the next thing, step by step by step. And that's critical. We cannot do all or none. That's how we fail. But a visible model of what I'm doing, I know what's good and bad, and WTI, yeah, work towards eliminating, work towards increasing, this should be the way.
Oh.
Anything short of that is us failing you. And we have over and over again.
And let's talk about work towards eliminating red meat. What else? Processed meats?
Definitely sugar.
Sugar?
Sugar is the biggest.
Sugar in any form. Now, you're not
simple
talking
sugars.
About, so the process. I can have fruit.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. So we're talking about processed table sugar and the different variations of sugar. You know, some people say, is honey good? Well, no. Honey is pure sugar. It just gets dissolved into your body. Same goes with agave, brown sugar, all the quote unquote natural processed sugars.
Here in LA, we saw all kinds of like Tasmanian sugar.
Those are all sugar.
Sugar. You can call it anything.
But if it's in the form of fruit, I mean, it's combined with fiber. It has a lot of water and minerals and vitamins, and our body's used to absorbing it.
Yeah.
And the fiber actually keeps the sugar in your gut for a long period of time and slowly and gradually releases it into the circulation so your brain doesn't go into a shock. Mm. So, you know, that's the way to do it.
Yes.
What about things that, so that's work to eliminate, and then the fruits we want to increase. What else should we try to increase?
Beans.
Yeah, beans, whole grains, vegetables of all kinds, especially greens and fruits. Berries have the most amount of anti-inflammatory products. So, you know.
Nuts.
Nuts and seeds.
All nuts?
All nuts,
Of course,
preferably not roasted and not salted in its raw form, are great because they're packed with monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated fats, which are the good fats that build the brain.
Well, let me ask you about roasted and salted, because I love a good cashew and I love a good almond.
Yes.
I love it if it's smoked and salted.
Of course,
Does that mean that I'm not getting the benefits of it because it's, I guess, processed in some way?
Well, yes. I mean, you could. So it's difficult to tell because, yeah, you're getting the good fats, but then you get the salt with it too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it depends on your baseline health. If you have bad blood vessels, and if you are on two different blood pressure medication, it's probably a good idea to not go with the salted roasted nuts.
Right.
But if, you know, once in a while you want to enjoy your nuts with salt, then that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, repeating, deprivation is failure.
Yes. Right.
But the alternative, which is just quitting on it, is obviously failure because we're, let's say how we have failed the healthcare system. And in 1990, when we first talked about obesity and diabetes, three states in America were obese. And
we're talking about type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, type 2 diabetes, yes. Only three states. So after all this talk, all this healthcare, public health, CDC, everything, which never translated to doctors, guess how many states are now obese?
50?
Yeah. Only three are not obese. Mm. So the point is, it's not translating. And if it's translating, it's translating in a way where we're failing people. Mm-hmm. And then the answer is, oh, maybe the research was wrong. So it must be the opposite. So it's not the fat that's bad. So fat must be good. No, that's false science. Mm. It's false reasoning. The reason it has failed is not that the data was wrong. It's that we are not able to translate from from research to the patients.
Mm.
Because the doctors, us doctors, don't know how to do it, and we don't have the time to do it, and we do the failure thing, which is all or none. Work around your strengths, work around your pleasures, work around what works for you, and then slowly eliminate the things that you can be successful in and move in that direction.
Exercise.
Yes.
Now, we asked you about this earlier, and someone suggested, well, is walking exercise? Can I, if I, you know, especially people on diets, they say, oh, just walk a half an hour a day or an hour a day, and that's good for your, you know, overall health. You say, no, that's not enough.
Well, it's better than not exercising. And we want to talk about sedentary behavior as well. You know, a lot of us, especially nowadays, you know, we sit behind our desks for hours and then we go and we exercise for half an hour and we're all happy. Like, oh, great, I did my quota for the day and I'm done. Mm-hmm. But that's not it. Sedentary behavior actually completely reverses the effect of that half an hour exercise that you did.
Really?
If you sit in front of your TV or behind your desk for 4 or 5 hours and not really, you know, keep moving naturally, it's of no benefit. That half an hour exercise is of no benefit. However, that said, yes, it is great to move around. It's good to walk. But for brain health specifically, for the amount of the chemicals that we need to grow the brain, that's not enough. Mm. Dean always tells his patients, you walk around the neighborhood, fabulous, but that's meditation. Mm-hmm. If you really want to start increasing the neurochemicals that actually grow the brain and increase those connections that we were talking about, you have to really push yourself to the point where you're sweating and you have a difficult time finishing a sentence. Mm. So increase your heart rate and do it in intervals. A lot of our patients have balance issues. They come in with arthritis and they say, you know what, doc, I can't run on the treadmill anymore. I feel very woozy and I've fallen a couple of times. Hey, how about having a reclined bike, a recumbent bike in your living room? Watch your show, keep on gliding, and once you get to the advertisement section, just push. Go really, really, really fast for about 2 to 3 minutes, and then just relax. And these intervals actually make a big difference.
Mm. Here's my pitch for becoming Secretary of Health and Human Services. Probably the opposite. If anybody thought about this, I say that if we connect every TV to a recumbent bike, so the TV will not come on until somebody pedals. Yeah. It doesn't have to pedal fast, but you know, just commercial, then everybody would do it. And that would change our healthcare system. It's a joke. I know it's a joke.
Right.
But reality is that kind of exercise where it's you're moving the whole time, very slowly, you know, 2 miles an hour, 1 mile an hour. But then during commercials, all of a sudden rev it up. And it's determined by your capacity. It's not a failure thing, all or none. And as time goes along, you go from one commercial in 2 hours to two commercials in 2 hours to three commercials over a period of time. It's not limited by the fact that you have to get up and wear clothes. You know, some of these gyms, you have to get more dressed up than some clubs. I mean, who wants to go there?
Right.
And you don't have to, you know, leave your comfortable home. It's the place you love. It's the shows you want to see. Nobody's judging you. It's all about proximity and ease.
Mm-hmm.
We fail people by creating these contrived things. You have to eat all vegetarian. Well, no, we know that a plant-based diet is great, but you work around your diet to work towards a more plant-based, less sugar diet. You have to do a marathon. I saw an article today. Runners have less likely to die young and also to have dementia and so on. So everybody thinks, oh, if I don't run 30 minutes, you know, run. Who can start at 30 minutes? I say do something that's doable in your proximity, in your home, around the home, and then build from that because that creates motivation.
Yeah.
That's the critical part of this book, building a model around you.
I see. And even, you know, if you are just, and I say just a walker, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, but if you walk and that is your exercise, you can increase your heart rate by going uphill.
Yes.
I mean, literally just walking uphill,
absolutely.
Try it. It will get your heart rate up. What about these things that you know, we hear these subscription programs on NPR that, you know, do this and it helps your brain, you do all these exercises and things like that. What do you think of those?
You're talking about mental and cognitive activities?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's really, the data was mixed and we still really don't know if those kind of, you know, gimmicky games here and there actually work. Although one of the reviews came back and showed that, you know, one of those 1980s games, like almost like a Pac-Man game, if, you know, somebody actually played that game on a regular basis consistently, had a lower risk of cognitive decline later on in life compared to those who didn't do it. Hmm. So any type of mental activity is good. But the problem that we have with those kind of subscriptions and games is that we're all seeking a quick fix. Hmm. We always want something that we can take as a pill, one game, one item that can get rid of whatever problems that we have as far as health is concerned. But it just doesn't work that way. It has to be a lifestyle. It has to be something comprehensive that you do on a regular basis. And so, you know, as far as cognitive activity is concerned, in our book, we've described different kinds of activities that people can own. Like, for example, I absolutely love music.
Mm-hmm.
That's my cognitive activity. Sitting in front of the piano, writing songs with my kids is my cognitive activity. It makes me happy, and I know that I'm actually pushing myself. For Dean, it's guitar. For my mom, it's knitting. Mm. And it's sitting with her friends and inviting them over and playing cards with them.
Mm.
So it has to be individualized. Otherwise, you can't really follow somebody else's rules.
And in general, the things to think about in terms of helping my brain in that regard, so it has to be something that uses multiple functions,
yes,
and there's a social component to it, or can I do it by myself?
If it has multiple components and a social, it's the best.
Okay.
Obviously, but even short of that, if it's multiple components, it's you, you're a shy person or whatever, that's actually still quite beneficial than just a simple linear activity.
Give me some examples of that.
Reading. So a lot of patients come to us and say, I love reading. Well, I say, that's wonderful. But reading is almost like watching TV for some of us. And for everybody, it's because it's just one. How about we've called four R's. Read, review, rewrite, and ramble. I needed a fourth R. So reading is visual. Reviewing is memory centers. You're actually recalling. You know, after you've read a chapter, now you're recalling. Rewriting is motor and thinking. And then rambling is your own thoughts about it. So now you've actually brought the entire brain around this activity. And it's also so cathartic. And it involves you in that story. But most importantly, it really challenges your brain around something you love.
Okay.
That's important. So to us, anything is better than nothing. Even these games are better than nothing. But one reason that it's a little harder to push our book, actually it's not, we're doing, there's a lot of demand, but we're pushing a little complexity. We're saying there is no one pill. In fact, even the vitamin story, there is no one vitamin. And the vitamin story, the data is, we actually had a video cast recently, only a few vitamins showed some benefit, but not tremendously. It's vitamins in the food form because they work together. The data shows that it's vitamin B12 plus omega-3 in a food form that actually has exponential benefit. So it comes back to the complexity of food, eating food, as opposed to the ease of just taking a bag full of vitamins, which we see often.
All the time.
Patients coming with two bags in their hand. And these are not benign things. They are chemicals. So they can actually harm you.
Yeah.
So a more complex approach to lifestyle, but the beauty is around your lifestyle can actually completely stave off your risk.
Yeah.
If you had a parent, if you had a sibling that had it, and you're starting to feel some cognitive decline, this is the time to take on the battle and reverse it, and that's not controversial.
How does that cognitive decline sort of present itself? So, as I said, I'm 53 years old. There are moments where I forget something, or you know, someone whose name has always been at the sort of in my brain. I think I can see their face. I can't think of their name. Is that cognitive decline, or is that just typical memory, or what is that?
I think we all have moments like that. I would say I probably have it more than anybody else. But I think it becomes a problem when your family notices it or when it affects your activities of daily living. When you have a hard time remembering your appointments, say, for example, or you have a hard time managing your finances, or you can't do the things that were very easy for you at some point, that's when it becomes a problem. But it's, you know, it's very, very important to not brush it off and to get it evaluated, even if you think it's not a very important issue at this point in your life. Because we know that some people who have subjective problems, they actually may be at a higher risk of developing a cognitive impairment later on.
Yeah, it's a combination of those. So the joke in the clinic is Dr. Charizardin is the preeminent memory doctor, but he loses more things than anybody else.
I can attest to that. Yeah, he leaves his coats everywhere.
but I have so many things to do. You know, it's multitasking, which actually there's no such thing as good multitasking. So that, because the brain.
But isn't
work.
That good for the brain to?
No, not multitasking. Oh. Multitasking is doing. So your brain has 100% capacity, and you're dividing it into 20-20-20-20. So you're doing everything poorly.
I see.
You can do linear fashion multiple acts, but it should be finish one and then the other.
Okay.
But that happens to all of us. But if three or four of these things, you lose your keys on, you know, once a week at least. You forget people's names at least once a week or so. You go to a new place or a place you've been to before, and it becomes a little uncomfortable because you don't know how to traverse the terrain. You're talking to somebody, and halfway through the sentence, more than once, you forget what you were trying to say. You know, a combination of these things, more than one or two, then it's good to actually get it checked out.
And if I come to you and you check me out and you say, you know what, you actually are early stage Alzheimer's, or you know, maybe the beginning of dementia, is it too late then?
No. So earlier, so if somebody comes with those symptoms, actually, first of all, they're not dementia. Dementia actually, in a very non-technical way, is when the person is unable to do one of their activities, such as driving, finance, cooking. As soon as one of those have happened, then it's dementia. But if you have forgetfulness, that's either just subjective cognitive impairment or what they call MCI, mild cognitive impairment. At those stages, definitely it's not too late. You can definitely reverse it. So that's why early identification, early evaluation, early symptom. And then what is the, what do you do for it? People say, oh, you're going to tell me lifestyle anyway. No, we would create a program around you and follow it and see how the successes happen and follow the progression. If somebody has Alzheimer's, fulminant Alzheimer's, although some people in now books are coming out saying that they've reversed Alzheimer's, they have not. Mm. Nobody has.
I
would challenge them to show me the data. But you can still affect the symptoms, meaning that if somebody has Alzheimer's or dementia, early stages, you can slow it down with lifestyle. That data is there. You can actually affect it significantly. You can affect the symptoms significantly. But for the great majority that are earlier stages where they're starting to have problems, you can reverse, stop, and affect for more than 90%. You can affect its course. That's why it's important. If you think you're having a combination of those, and if somebody's noticed as well, get it checked.
Absolutely.
I heard anecdotally someone said that if you lose your keys, it's okay. If you don't know what your keys do anymore, if you're not sure what the function of the key is, that's the issue.
If you don't know what the function of the key is for a second or two, that's worrisome enough to get it checked.
Right.
But if you've forgotten it for more than that, then definitely that's worrisome. Absolutely. That's beautiful. Yeah.
All right. We've filled people's brains with all sorts of information here. I want to take a short break. When we come back, I want to try to give people some immediate steps that they can take right now.
Yes.
After they listen to this podcast, so a few concrete things you can do immediately to put yourself in the best position so that you don't get Alzheimer's. If you're not in that 5-10%
correct
grouping, what can you do? We're going to get to that in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment with Drs. Dean and Aisha Sherzai.
Introducing the completely redesigned Mercedes-Benz E-Class. It's everything you need it to be, and so much more. Frank Buckley Interviews is presented by the Mercedes-Benz Dealers of Southern California. Visit mbsocal.com for dealer details.
We're back with Dr. Dean and Dr. Aisha Sherzai. They are the neurologists and co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. They've written a book, The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. I told everyone that you would now give us some concrete steps on what we can do today to start ourselves down the right path. So yeah, Let's do that.
So first of all, let's start with the person themselves. This is actually very good. Get a notebook, get a piece of paper, and write this down. In the neuro, N-E-U-R-O, nutrition, exercise, stress, unwind, sleep, restorative sleep, and optimizing medical condition and mental activity. So for those, which one of those are the most challenging for you? And where is the opportunity? So if nutrition is the biggest challenge, and we know what we've talked about, what's bad and what's good. In nutrition, what one element that you think is bad or what we've told you is bad that you can truly successfully stop or reduce significantly? Mm-hmm. Let's start there. And by the way, have a notebook or a whiteboard, because nothing is more successful if you have it visually checked off.
Around you.
So if it's conspicuous, you can see it, you can check it off, that creates success.
So let's give an example with these.
Yes.
So let's on food, I'm eating processed meat every day in my, let's say I'm having bacon.
Yes.
5 days a week. You would say what?
Reduce it to 3 or 2 days.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's a tremendous success,
right?
At least for a month, and then see how you do and then go from there.
Right.
And then you can actually go to another food category, sugar. And then you can go to increasing certain things, like if you didn't, you know, vegetables of all kinds, of all colors in your food. Then you can go. So in that stepwise fashion, actually plan it out. One of the things we talk about is planning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the core of everything is planning.
Absolutely. Because that will completely take care of multiple steps for you. Preparation and planning makes it easy for a habit to follow. Say, for example, I work in a place where I can easily get a muffin after lunch or dinner, and that just satiates me, and that gets rid of that energy dip at 3 p.m. What I do is, okay, I'm not going to take that muffin. I'm not going to eat that muffin three times in a week, and I'm going to replace that with either a banana or a cup of fruit or something of that nature, and just check it off.
I started doing that myself this summer. I've lost 17 pounds over the summer.
Fabulous.
And a lot of it was just planning it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So throughout the show, we're constantly eating on the show. And I try not to eat. I mean, I try to have a bite just to you know make sure I've tasted the food for the chef who's brought it on. But I bring, you saw me earlier, I eat apples.
Yes.
I bring an apple every day.
Fantastic.
I mean, apple a day keeps the doctor away.
That's
really
true.
Is true.
Sure, yes.
I slice it up in the morning. I bring it in a bag. Mm-hmm. I bring, often today, I had mango and pineapple.
Wonderful.
And I nibble on that. A little bit of turkey. I know that's meat, but I have had a couple of slices of turkey. And one slice of wheat toast that I slice up into soldiers. And, you know, it just sort of gets me through the morning in a way that, so I'm not starving by the time the food segment happens at 9:45. And then I eat like I've never been, fed before in my life. You know, so just, that's what I've done. And it has worked for me.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on to, that's nutrition. What's exercise?
So exercise depends. So look at your limitations. Is it time? Is it space? Is it physical limitations like knee pain or something of that nature? That will determine what you should do.
Do you like it?
Or
some
do you
people
like
just
it? Exactly.
Don't like exercise at all.
So if you have certain limitations like balance, or even then I'd say a recumbent bike or a stationary bike or a little foot pedal exercise or right in front of the living room. For others, I like this walking pattern that we talked about with this in the morning, especially. A morning walk has multiple benefits. We're talking about sleep. One of the things about sleep is the circadian clock in our brain is actually reset by light. An early light is beneficial, so that actually affects the circadian. You start the energy cycle starts in the morning, so that starts the whole cycle starts from there. As well as the fact that the exercise itself makes you tired for the next day. Whenever you're at the beach, walking around, the sun, everybody sleeps well that night. So a combination of benefit. Exercise, resetting the clock, so that's another way if you're a walker. A third thing is if you're more motivated, then do a little walk, a run, a bike, whatever it is. But start now, start around what you like and start small. And start in a way where you can check it off, meaning it's visible. The changes are visible. Today I did a 1 mile bike ride around the neighborhood, and you have it on a whiteboard checking off. Tomorrow, I guarantee you, that motivation will get you to 1.2 miles and on and on.
Yeah.
So a visible activity around your strengths and your proclivities is the most important way to do exercise, not just a blunt, everybody should go run. No, I'm not going to run.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. Or do Sudoku. Now everybody knows what I want to do.
The next one is you.
Yes.
What is that
unwind.
One?
Stress.
Stress.
Unwind.
Yes.
Unwind.
Yes.
So what can we do to unwind?
So stress. And I think, as a woman, I can tell that a lot of women actually have more stress than men.
Well, justified. They think that I'm causing stress.
No. Yes. Sorry. Your podcast show. No. Not at all. Did not mean that. You're quite helpful. Very supportive. But, women have a lot of stress. And, all of us have stress. But I think the first thing and the most important thing that we can do is to identify it. Just say, this act, this issue or even a person is causing a lot of stress. Once we identify it and just take a Sharpie and circle around it and say, this is one of the things that I want to eliminate from my life, and then slowly and gradually working towards eliminating it is the best thing we can all do. A lot of times we just glide through our day not knowing what is it that actually stresses us out. And for me personally, that has helped, because once I identify something that I don't have any control over, I can get myself away from it slowly and gradually.
I see.
And, not all stress is bad. There's bad stress. That's a bad stress. When something is really bothering you and you have no control over it. There's good stress too. The good stress is the one that keeps you agitated enough where you're alert, where you attend to it, where you can own it, and you can successfully change it into either an action or a beneficial activity for somebody else. And so identification is probably the most important thing. And then, what do you do about it? Spend more time with people who actually motivate you and not stress you out. If your job is stressful, find out if there's anything you can do about it. Either you know, shun away from it or change that energy into something more positive. And, you know, before you know it, it's going to be a positive force in your life.
So basically identifying and well, defining it is critical and making sure that you put the kind of stresses that are important to you, that serves your purpose. I mean, study after study, book after book, keeps talking about purpose, mm-hmm. sense of purpose, you know, from World War II and on and on and on everywhere.
Well, yeah, you hear about people who work in a very stressful job for 30 or 40 years, they retire, and then they die immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it seems like that purpose that they had and the stress that they had, now they've eliminated, they think, oh, this is wonderful. But actually, it seems like we need something to wake up for.
Exactly. So what you just described is one of the biggest determinants of decline is when a person retires, the group that continues to be active, they live much longer and healthier than those that just say, oh, now I retired, I'm going to sit back.
Yeah.
They wither quickly. Mm. So maintaining a sense of purpose and activity and is actually stressful, but in a good stress.
Yeah.
So that's important. So we redefine the stresses. And then on a daily basis, something that we've instituted, although I'm not a big
meditation
person, but the data in the book, we've talked about all the data on the meditation. But in our own life, we have a 10-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son where we do this breathing exercise. It's simple. I mean, we did this in the Sinai Temple here.
Yes.
Whole group, we're deep breath. Mm-hmm. I say, close your eyes. I'm telling your audience, close your eyes. You have a lot of people now close.
Yeah.
And deep breath through your nose and out your mouth. Just this simple act. I mean, this is incredibly cathartic and releasing, just that act. Now, the addition of knowing how to relax the muscles around your neck, your shoulder, your abdomen, your legs, you learn how to do this well. Then, while you're in that state for 5 minutes, putting yourself in a calm state, maybe on a beach and then visualizing one object, that brings focus. Those four things. My daughter came to us and said, Dad, my life has changed. I was like, you're 10 years old. You're not allowed to say that. But it's amazing, just a simple act that's yours, which is breathing in and out, relaxing, learning how to relax the muscles, and then visualizing and focusing completely changes your perspective. We say 5 minutes twice a day, start with that.
Mm. And meditation can be different for different people. Yeah. Like I myself cannot sit still and close my eyes. I have a very difficult time doing that.
Mm.
For me, a repetitive action like walking and just counting my steps actually works really well.
Huh.
With some good music in the background, I completely disconnect myself with my daily routine. So it can be different things for different people.
Yeah, I've found that riding a bike, I've become a cyclist over the last couple of years, and that the sound of the wheels going around and myself breathing and until a car gets in my way, then I'm not meditating anymore. But I do find that it sort of is helpful.
It is. It is. Absolutely.
And exercising at the same time. All right. So that's taken us to unwind.
Yes.
Are we to R?
Yes.
Yes.
Give us a concrete step?
So finding out whether you have a sleep disorder is probably the first step to move forward. A lot of people here in the United States have sleep apnea and we don't know it.
Mm.
They snore. They have daytime sleepiness. They can't focus anymore, and they usually end up having sleep apnea. And just finding that out significantly makes a big difference.
And how do I find out?
Getting a sleep study, talking to your doctor, a referral to a sleep specialist or a neurologist who's specialized in sleep, getting a polysomnogram, which is a test where you actually go to a clinic and you sleep and they put, electrodes on your forehead and they measure your breathing pattern, and then finding out whether you actually go into those stages of sleep.
Mm.
And if you don't, then there's, of course, treatment for it, whether it's a CPAP machine or changing, cognitive behavioral therapy, whatever it may be. But finding out whether you have a sleep disorder is probably the first step. And then from then on, managing your sleep patterns, making sure that your bedroom is the most wonderful space to sleep. It has to be dark. It has to be cool or a specific temperature that you're comfortable with. It has to even have the right bed sheets that you actually feel comfortable in. So all of those things.
And if I don't have insurance or I can't afford to go to a sleep specialist or maybe I don't have the time, is there any sort of hack to that? I mean, I guess if my wife says, you snore all the time, or if you find that you're waking up in the middle of sleep, you probably have sleep apnea.
Yeah. There's no hack around sleep apnea, even though their commercials for these devices. And because there's it's such a big market, people are going to come up with all kinds of devices. None of them have been validated. So that's something that there's no way around. You have to find out if you have sleep apnea and what will it respond to. And even with if you're they're using sleep CPAP machine, if they haven't gone back to their doctor, this machine may have gone out of alignment. So they're using a machine, which is actually a little difficult. There's no question about it. But it's incredibly important for them. Their sleep apnea means you're not getting oxygen to the brain. I mean, all the diet in the planet we could put on wouldn't reverse that. So that's important. Outside of sleep apnea, if somebody's using sleep medication every night or you know several times a week, you have to find out what's the cause. Is it is it anxiety? Is it the environment? Or is it sleep pattern that have gone awry? You can do sleep hygiene. We've written extensively about that. And how to slowly come off of the medication. Not right away. Slowly come off the medication. Because a lot of medications knock you out. Just because you're out doesn't mean you've slept through the cycles.
Right.
A lot of medications actually alter the cycles. So it's critical to know why you're having sleep problems, how to adjust it through sleep hygiene and other techniques. And then and only then, if everything else has worked, then slowly introducing some kinds of medications that we've actually talked about. And sleep is critical.
Yeah.
This 8 hours where your body, your brain restores itself. These cells in the brain called microglia, at night they go and eat away bad connections or unuseful connections. I'm using connections that have been old or not working or whatever. When people who haven't slept or have slept poorly, these microglia actually start eating good cells, good connections.
Goodness.
So it's actually basically eating the brain.
Wow.
So it's critical to address the sleep issue, and that's that. There are no hacks around that.
Okay. And the last one is O.
Optimizing medications, and that's important. A lot of times people have blood pressure problems, and this is a big one. In my own family, they're happy that they took their blood pressure medicine, but they never check the blood pressure. Oh, I go to the doctor once every 3 months. Blood pressure is something that vacillates from minute to minute. And if you have blood pressure problems, you should check it regularly in your own place and make sure that your device is working and write it down so the doctor can act upon data that's long-term instead of once every 3 months.
So when you go for that quarterly visit, you can say, here's my entire chart.
Exactly.
That snapshot you have in the clinic is not a good representation of your blood pressure during the moment.
Correct.
It's so important.
Exactly. We've seen so many patients who've got perfect blood pressure throughout the day, but when you check in the morning, because that's where the cortisol goes up, the blood pressure is in the 180s. Well, 180 is basically you're having microstrokes in the brain. So what if you're taking two medications twice a day, but when it's critical, it's not? So blood pressure management, cholesterol management, sugar management, even if you have no diabetes but insulin resistance, those are medications until lifestyle takes over.
Okay.
That has to be optimized. You have to have a good doctor that knows how to manage that. Then after that, it's optimizing social and mental activity. And that's the fun part, but the hard part. It's not what I can prescribe to you. I can't send you to a website where you follow dots on a screen. Yeah, it has to be around your likes, what you loved, what drove you, what interested you. But it has to be something that challenges you throughout.
And so in terms of a social activity, something that everyone can do right now.
Cards.
Cards?
Yeah, let's play cards.
Right.
You and I are playing cards.
Yeah.
I'm so
bad
at it.
But it can't be solitaire. It has to be
social.
Find a friend and say.
So even solitaire is fine as long as it's challenging. But here's four people playing.
Yeah.
First, the cards distributed to everybody else. You have to know the rules of the card. So that's memory. And then you have to interact and read other people. That's the judgment. You have to converse. Sometimes those card games can get a little, interesting. And that's, knowing what the other person said and responding. That's challenging the brain. It's emotional. It's visual. It's processing. It's the entire brain. And it's a life.
Yeah.
It's not following a dot on a screen.
Right.
How long are you going to follow a dot on a screen? You only have so many years. Playing cards are way better in a group.
Yeah.
Especially cards that are challenging.
Yeah.
Especially if you have healthy snacks at the game.
Yes.
And then you dance after the card game.
Oh my gosh.
That's a perfect evening for brain health, isn't it?
Exactly. That's a beautiful night.
Well, I think we'll end it on that note. It's really wonderful information. Once again, the name of the book, I'll have it on my podcast page. But the Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. We want to thank Doctors Dean and Aisha Sherzai for a wonderful hour. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us. It was so much fun. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Team Sherzai. Again, their new book coming out in March is The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution, and I'm sure we'll have them on the KTLA Morning News to talk about it. If you have any feedback on today's podcast, I hope you'll tag me on social media at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram. And please share the conversation with your friends if you think they might benefit from it. Thanks for listening this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.